Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Glad to be back with you on this Sunday evening. It's another scorcher here in the desert tonight. A funky, gunky, cloudy soup has hovered low over the Las Vegas Valley all day, thick with smoke from California wildfires. Those fires just gobbling up acreage in several locations here in the Southwest. Kind of comes with the territory, I guess. It seems to get hotter and drier each summer. Lots of cheatgrass and invasive weeds growing out there in the desert. They go up in flames every time somebody tosses a cigarette butt out the window or a bolt of lightning strikes. To all of our many listeners in Southern California and elsewhere in the Southwest here, hope your families and your homes are not in harm's way tonight. We have a very full program on tap, so I'm going to get right to it and not mess around. 41 years ago today, former Teamster boss Jimmy Hoffa was relaxed, smiling. He posed for photos in what looks like somebody's backyard, having no idea that less than 1 week later, he would vanish, setting off an enduring American mystery. There are more theories about what happened to Hoffa than you can count. A lot of hunches about who might have killed him and why they killed him, where he was buried, all kinds of crazy theories about that. Or whether he simply decided to blow town, hide out in Brazil with his girlfriend or something. That's a theory that's kicked around as well. In 2004, writer, former prosecutor Charles Brandt published what became a New York Times bestseller, I Heard You Paint Houses. That's the title, unusual. I Heard You Paint Houses. It's underworld slang. It means I heard you kill people. And those were reportedly the first words that Jimmy Hoffa ever uttered to a huge, hulking mountain of muscle named Frank Sheeran, known far and wide as the Irishman. Those two became close friends, confidants. Their families were close, and Sheeran, a hitman, did jobs for Hoffa as well as for the mafia. Charles Brandt came to be the lawyer for Frank Sheeran, and it took him many years to drag the full story out of Sheeran, but eventually he got a confession, not only to that he killed his friend, Jimmy Hoffa, but other shocking, unsolved crimes as well. A new version of the book is now out. It'll be also a major motion picture involving some of the biggest names in Hollywood. We're going to talk about that project as well. There have been so many developments that Charlie Brandt could not reveal until now for good reasons, and tonight we get to hear all of it, including new information about what role Sheeran may have played in the JFK assassination. Charles Brandt will join me just minutes from now. In the second half of the program tonight, we welcome back film producer and screenwriter Paul Davids. Earlier this year, you might recall, we spoke to Paul about a book he had co-written and a film he put together focused on his late friend, Forrest Ackerman. Ackerman was a legend in the world of horror movies, sci-fi magazines, monster fanzines, you name it. In fact, Ackerman is the person credited with coining the term sci-fi. He was a lifelong atheist who playfully joked with friends that if he really did somehow survive death, he'd come back and let them know. Well, looks like maybe he did. Dozens of incidents later, it seems like Ackerman, or Forry, is having a laugh at the expense of his pals, and perhaps sending the rest of us a message about what happens to us after we die. Paul David's book is now out, so we invited him to return to the program. And he's bringing along Dr. John Allison, a distinguished chemist who got roped into helping analyze some of the physical evidence in this Ackerman case. And then he had some weird stuff happen to him as well. That's in the second half of the program tonight. Should be a lot of fun. And I promise we'll save time for you folks in the audience to ask some questions of each of these guests as well. On the Coast to Coast website tonight, webmaster Greg Bishop and I have put together our usual eclectic batch of items and oddities culled from the worlds of news and science. We call it Knapp's News. Among the stories posted there tonight, a scientist who thinks he's found evidence for the existence of parallel dimensions. That would be a big one. That would be a mind bender if it is confirmed by others. Also, how the quantum world and gravity fit together or don't fit together, how they affect each other. An intriguing piece about supposed talks ongoing very quietly between the U.S. and Russia to launch a joint effort to build a base on the moon. Sounds like quiet discussions have been underway for a while now, and that would be an intriguing possibility. And as sort of a companion piece for the Jimmy Hoffa story tonight, something in the same vein, Mystery and Murder in Yosemite, a really strange and twisted tale that takes you down some very dark roads. Check it out when you have some time. Also, while you're there on the Coast website, click on the link telling you how to become a Coast Insider. It's a cost of about 15 cents a day to join. Gives you access to our huge library of programs, hundreds of previous shows. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on any device of your choice. It's still a great deal. And while you're there, you can look at information on how to see George Norrie's Beyond Belief television program. I think it airs on Gaia, the Gaia Network, but a lot of people don't get Gaia. And if you subscribe to this online, you can see it anytime you want for fans of that program. I think George has a new novel coming out this week. We might have to get him on the program here with us at some point to talk about it. With that, let's get ready to rumble. Bring in the dog and cat. It's too hot outside for them anyway. Pour yourself a big cup of Joe, slide into those silky jammies and the bunny slippers, plop yourself down in the Barca lounger, turn down the light, and turn up that radio. In a moment, the death of Jimmy Hoffa and the story of the guy who did it, with my guest, Charles Brandt. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. You know, being a reporter in Las Vegas and covering mob stories for many years, it's kind of a natural thing that I would have an interest in Jimmy Hoffa. I mean, who doesn't? Hoffa's Teamsters Union pension fund built modern Las Vegas. Loans from that fund went into pretty much every hotel on the Strip in the 60s and early 70s. The casinos in those days couldn't get loans from regular banks. It just wasn't done. So along with these Teamster loans, the loans from the pension fund, strings were attached, and those strings involved mobsters. So mobsters would be put into these casinos, and then tens of millions of dollars were skimmed from those casinos and sent to mafia bosses all across the country. Jimmy Hoffa was a tough guy who learned how to sort of survive with a foot in both camps. 41 years ago this week, he had no idea that the clock was ticking, that he had only a few days to live. His disappearance, July 30th, 1975, set off a national furor and speculation that continues to this day about what happened to him. In my opinion, the issue was resolved for good once Charles Brandt came out with his book, I Heard You Paint Houses, with the story of Frank the Irishman Sheeran. A new updated version has just been released. You can judge for yourself as you hear the story unfold tonight. Welcome back to the program, author, former prosecutor, Charles Brandt. Charlie, great to have you here.
Great to hear your voice again, George. It's been too long.
Yeah, absolutely. The new version of this book, exciting stuff. I mean, especially the last part, things that you could not write, could not say before, because it would have put your life at risk. Am I exaggerating?
No, not even a little bit. The mafia, as Frank Sheeran taught me, has an expression, when in doubt, have no doubt. So if they have any doubts about you, you're gone.
Is there anyone left who might take offense to what you put out there?
No. And believe me, if there were anyone left who might take offense, I wouldn't put it out there.
Let's start with Hoffa. 41 years ago, we've got a picture that I found that was taken on this date 41 years ago. He's got 6 days to live. He seems unguarded and relaxed and smiling in this photo. We're putting it on the website. What was he doing in this period of his life that made it all but certain that he would be killed? Sort of set the stage there.
Sure. In the photo, he was posing. He was at his lake cottage. He had a cottage in a lake in north of Detroit. And he was promoting himself to be the next president of the Teamsters. He had been the president of the Teamsters from 1957 until 1967, when he was put in jail through the efforts of the Attorney General, former Attorney General Bobby Kennedy. And he was sprung from jail by a pardon given to him by Richard Nixon when some cash changed hands. But in the pardon, there were restrictions on his running for office again. he couldn't run in the next election. And he fought those restrictions in court, and he campaigned like crazy to become the president again. The rank and file loved him. The people that weren't happy about his return were those mafia bosses that had more of an unlimited access to the Central States Pension Fund than they had when he was in charge of it. His replacement, a man named Frank Fitzsimmons, was scared to death of the mafia, and he gave them whatever they wanted. He gave them terms that Hoffa would never have given them on loans to build casinos. Everything Hoffa did with them was collateralized. Now, he did take some points under the table for his own use, but the Teamsters Pension Fund was protected by Hoffa. It was not protected by Fitzsimmons, and that enabled the mafia to make more money out of Fitzsimmons with some loans that were absolutely fraudulent. And they would just pocket the millions in cash. And Hoffa was threatening to put an end to that when he took back the Teamsters. He was also expected to win his lawsuit. And it was really going to be a slam dunk. The president had the power to pardon Hoffa, but he had no power to put restrictions on what Hoffa did with his life once he was pardoned. So,
you know, if you just look at the last part of his life, you could say he was a bad guy. He was in bed with the mob, you know, and he was taking things under the table, and was a, you know, he deserved what he got coming. But looking at the earlier parts of his life, I mean, it really does seem like he was sincere about really being in the corner of the working man and turning his union into a force for good for workers, but sure didn't work out that way.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because it's true. It's also true of Frank Sheeran. The words, "I heard you paint houses," spoken by Jimmy Hoffa to Frank Sheeran, that was a job interview. Frank was working for Russell Bufalino, the most powerful mob boss in America at the time, and he was doing hits for Russell Bufalino. Hoffa said to Russell, who was an ally of his at the time, "I need some muscle. I just became president." And Russell recommended The Irishman to him. They had a conversation over the phone, and Frank Sheeran then went to work for Hoffa. Frank was totally impressed with the work that Hoffa did for the working men and women of America, not just his own Teamsters, and the efforts he put in on their behalf. And so was the mafia. They didn't run the Central States Pension Fund like they were going to once Hoffa went to jail. They cooperated with each other, but they respected Hoffa for that. And Sheeran became the same way. He worked very hard for the men in his local. He was head of the Teamsters local in Wilmington, Delaware, where I was practicing law. And they took that part of their life seriously. Now, at the same time, Frank Sheeran was a murderer. At the same time, Jimmy Hoffa ordered hits on what people he perceived to be standing in the way of the progress he wanted to make in the union.
People who are too young to have been around at that time, you know, maybe they've seen a documentary or something, seen references to Hoffa or read newspaper articles or something, but it's hard to express what a colossal figure he was in American life. I mean, he was all over the place. He was powerful and passionate.
In my book, I say that Americans at the time could identify Elvis Presley's voice instantly when they heard it on the radio or television. And the same was true of Jimmy Hoffa. Everybody could hear the sound of his voice giving one of his famous speeches, attacking big business, attacking those who he felt were taking advantage of the working men and women and not willing to pay the wages that he felt his people needed to receive.
Why was it necessary for Hoffa to cut a deal with the mob to open the door and let him in? What did he need from them?
Going back, it was a deal that was in place when he took over. He expanded it. And what it emanated from was that management were hiring Italian goons to break strikes. They would come in with billy clubs and break the strike, and the picketers would scatter. And they got the idea, the Teamsters especially got the idea, of making an alliance with these mobsters that supplied the thugs. And that led to more and more involvement. You know, when you get involved with the mafia, it doesn't take much, and you're theirs. And that's how Frank got involved with them. The book is actually a biography of Frank Sheeran, who led an incredible life. The main feature of his life, I would think, are the 411 combat days he spent in World War II in General Patton's killer division. Patton christened the division the Thunderbird Division, my killer division, and you're not to take prisoners. The original crimes for war atrocities against American servicemen were against the Thunderbird Division right after the invasion of Sicily, where prisoners were killed. And that's, Frank spent 411 days in combat when the average was 80, and when at 200 days, you were eligible for a discharge. He had been a Huckleberry Finn kind of guy before the war. He came out of the war a changed man. And Frank was a strict Irish Catholic. His father studied for the priesthood for 5 years. His mother went to Mass every morning. And during the 5 years I had Frank, I had also been raised Catholic. I was able to work on that and bring that out of him. I'm a guy who taught interrogation to cops. I solved lots of crimes as a homicide investigator through interrogation. I taught cross-examination to other trial lawyers. In 1988, I wrote a book, The Right to Remain Silent, based and I was still practicing law at the time, based on the crimes that I had solved through interrogation. And Frank was in my domain for 5 years, the last 5 years of his life. And in that period, we talked a lot about his Catholic faith and about the hereafter and about his coming clean and making a clean breast of it before he died. And that was his aim at the end of his life. During his times with Hoffa, of course, you did what you were told. During his times with Russell Bufalino, you did what you told. As Frank said to me, if I ever said no to Russell, Jimmy would have been just as dead, and I'd have gone to Australia with him, meaning I'd have gone down under and been killed with him. And Frank got into this line of work with Russell Bufalino totally by accident. When he got out of the war, he said, we didn't have war syndrome in those days. You'd wake up in a bed wondering what you were doing in a bed, and your whole body would be sweating. He said that he never slept more than 4 hours a night after the war. And he just was on overload. He was overwhelmed by 411 combat days.
It sort of burned him, burned his brain, sort of erased his conscience, I guess, in a sense.
It truly did. Certainly the Catholic conscience that he had been raised with was in there somewhere, but it needed work to bring it out again. But he was in three amphibious invasions, Salerno, Anzio, and southern France, with lots of bullets being thrown at you as you wade ashore. And he was, when he got out of the war, he began to work as a truck driver for Food Fair, an East Coast supermarket chain. And he wasn't really doing much of anything wrong. I mean, little stuff. He played football for the local Catholic football team, parish football team. And he got married. And initially he had three daughters. And one day he was at a truck stop outside of Elmira, New York. And his horse, what they call his truck, he couldn't get it started. And this Italian man, older Italian man, came over to him and said, let me give you a hand. And it was Russell Bufalino. I mean, a fascinating person. Russell was, in addition to the mafia boss that the CIA contacted when they decided they wanted to kill Castro, Bufalino was also a master mechanic. He fixed Sheeran's horse, got his rig started, and there was something about Frank Sheeran, 6'4", tough as nails, hard-edged, kind of a film noir character, post-war Frank Sheeran. And he invited Frank Sheeran to hang out a little bit at a bar in Philly and a restaurant in Philly, the Friendly Tavern. Sheeran began hanging out there. Then they began to give Sheeran little ways of making money.
Hold on there a second. Charles Brandt is my guest. We're talking about his book, I Heard You Paint Houses, about the man who befriended and later killed Jimmy Hoffa. The circumstances later on in Coast to Coast AM. That's from the album Blood on the Tracks, Bob Dylan, Tangled Up in Blue, from 1975. In fact, all the songs we're playing in this hour are from 1975. Sort of put you in the era when Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. And if you've ever wondered what became of Hoffa, why he was killed, or who did it, or what happened to the body, you got to check out this excellent book by Charles Brandt, I Heard You Paint Houses. It was a number one bestseller before. It's going to be made into a major motion picture. We'll talk about that in a moment. But it lays out the case of why it sure looks like Frank the Irishman Sheeran was right there at the scene involved with the murder of Hoffa, and also knows about what happened to the body. We're going to get into specifics on that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. As we just heard a couple of minutes ago, through a sort of a prophetic coincidence, Frank the Irishman Sheeran meets Russell Bufalino on the side of the road. Russell Bufalino is quite a figure in mafia circles. You know, Charlie, I remember after your book first came out, some other mob writers, you know, it's a fraternity of sorts, but it can be kind of nasty at times. They would write, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Russell Bufalino wasn't a major figure. He was the head of a small mafia family in Pennsylvania. He wasn't that much of a heavy hitter. To which you would say what?
Oh, it's silly. Russell was, let me just back up and say that the FBI solved the whodunit part of Hoffa's disappearance within 2 months. Bob Garrity, who is now a dear friend of mine, was the case agent in charge. And Bob put a memo together called the Hoffex Memo. Yeah. All of these other writers are people who rely on Bob Garrity's Hoffex Memo. And in the Hoffex Memo, there are nine suspects listed. Chief among them was Frank the Irishman Sheeran, and his boss, Russell Bufalino. And eight of those nine actually were involved. So that's silly. And as we sit here now, the FBI is in the possession of the final bit of corroboration that Sheeran was the killer of Jimmy Hoffa. But in any event, I met Bob Garrity. Let me just back up and say one thing about these other guys. They're writers. They're journalists. They're investigative journalists. And no offense to investigative journalists who have done major investigations, but this is really their only murder case. I solved murder cases for a living. I interrogated suspects. I solved crimes by interrogating suspects. And I had Frank Sheeran to myself for close to 5 years. I didn't just have him on a witness stand for an afternoon. So I could ask him about something today and 2 years later, ask him about it again and see if he said it with the same energy and the same detail as he did the first time. So it's silly for anyone to quibble. But as far as what the FBI has, let me just fill the audience in. That you mentioned that there's a new edition, and that's what I'm out there now doing, plugging this new edition. The new edition has 57 additional pages. These were things, as you mentioned, that I didn't want to tell before, because there were mob figures that were still alive, and I didn't want to get on the wrong side of some of these figures. Chief among them was a guy named Billy D'Elia. Billy took over the Bufalino crime family when Russell died. Let me tell you first how powerful Russell Bufalino was. After I wrote I Heard You Paint Houses, I wrote a book with the real Donnie Brasco, Joe Pistone, a sequel to Donnie Brasco. It was called Donnie Brasco Unfinished Business, material that he didn't tell in the first book, not because of his fear of mob bosses, because he's fearless. He's a dear friend of mine.
I know. I got to meet him in connection with that book. Yeah, he's an interesting guy.
Oh, that's right. You did that book, Donnie Brasco Unfinished Business. But in any event, I just lost my train of thought.
Well, he's talking about Bufalino and his power, I think.
Bufalino. Joe introduced me to Al Martino, the singer who played Johnny Fontaine in the three Godfather movies. And Al told me how Russell Bufalino got him his job in The Godfather. The director, Francis Ford Coppola, wanted to use a real actor instead of a singer for the Johnny Fontaine part. They could dub in a voice, a singing voice. But Al wanted that part. So he went to his godfather, Russell, and his godfather, Russell, gave him that part. And I was giving a talk at the Sun Valley Writers Conference, and I told that anecdote about Al Martino, the late Al Martino. He died in October 2009 of a heart attack. But I told that story. A woman came up to me afterwards and introduced herself. She said her name was Wanda Ruddy and that her husband was Al Ruddy, who was the producer of The Godfather. I'd never heard of Al Ruddy. You know, I just go to the movies and associate that movie with Francis Ford Coppola. Anyway, she said to me that Al and I ought to have a talk about Russell. And she asked me, did you know that Russell had final script approval of the movie The Godfather? And of course, I didn't know that, but I now know that. And that's in the new edition. You mentioned the new edition. It has 57 pages, as I said, that I couldn't put in before, as well. These are good mafia anecdotes and good lessons about how the mafia operates. But as well, there is corroboration in the 57 pages, because with each new edition of the book, along comes people who have something to say, as Wanda Ruddy had something to say to me. The three major unsolved crimes, unsolved murders of the 20th century was Jimmy Hoffa, Crazy Joey Gallo at Umberto's Clam House in Little Italy in New York, and what happened to JFK. Well, Frank Sheeran was involved in all three, and all three have been corroborated. And the corroboration appears in the 57 pages.
We'll come back to JFK a little bit later. I want to back to Bufalino. It just occurred to me that if you were really smart and you were a mafia guy, you'd want to keep a low profile as possible. It doesn't hurt your feelings if somebody else looks like they're the big shot mafia boss that's pulling the strings. You'd prefer it that way.
Well, you'd prefer it that way. Now, there was the ruling commission in place in New York City, the Five Families. Russell was not a member of the Five Families, but the Five Families never did anything of any consequence without running it by Russell, consulting him, and getting his planning and approval. And Russell planned the hit on Hoffa. Russell supplied Frank Sheeran as the hitman, as the only one that could get close enough to Hoffa in those troubled days, get close enough to him and get him alone to kill him. And that's, it's beyond question corroborated. Here's the way it was corroborated in the conclusion chapter. The replacement for Russell Bufalino when he died was his underboss and nephew, Billy Scalia.
Right.
When I traveled with Frank Sheeran during those 5 years, I was kind of undercover in the sense that I was posing as a guy who was going to write a book restoring Frank Sheeran's name. There were six books about Hoffa's disappearance, and every one of them, relying on Bob Garrity's Hoffex memo, gave a role of some kind to Frank Sheeran. And Frank was going to be cleared by my book. While he was out there saying that to these people, he and I were involved in our own interrogation process, and he was giving me serial confession after serial confession. Frank did 25 to 30 hits, so there was a lot of material there. And one day, I went to a birthday party for Frank, and Billy D'Elia was there. He had taken over the family. And of course, eight guys named Rocco. And I left after the candles were blown out. I said to Frank, I've got to get back to my law office. I was still practicing law then. That night, Frank called me up and said, you know what that Billy said about me after you left? Said about you after you left? I said, no, Frank, what did Billy say about me? And, you know, you don't want to hear that the mafia boss of the Bufalino family is saying anything about you. Frank said, Billy turned to me and he said, do I trust that guy? I said, do I trust that guy? If it wasn't for that guy, I'd still be in jail for 10 more years. You know, I had gotten Frank out of jail. That's how I began this relationship with him, on medical grounds, early parole. And I said to Frank, wait a minute, what did the boss of the Buffalino family say about me? That's all I care about. Oh, F him. I never liked that mother effer, and he never liked me. I said, Frank, hold on now. You taught me. You taught me, when in doubt, have no doubt. The boss of the Buffalino family has doubt about me. Ah, F him. I never liked that mother effer, and he never liked me. Oh, Frank, is this supposed to make me feel better? So there was the guy that didn't like me. I knew it. When you read the original edition of this book, there's no mention of Billy D'Elia in the book at all. Not even a little bit. No reference to him, not even by his nickname. And then there was a new edition that came out with an epilogue. I didn't mention Billy D'Elia again. Then one day, Billy gets arrested. He gets arrested for ordering hits on two government witnesses. He orders them to a guy that's already cooperating with the FBI and is wearing a wire. Now they got Billy for life sentence, ordering two hits. They make a deal with him. He becomes a cooperating witness. And the first question they asked him when they went to see him in jail was what happened to Hoffa. And he told them to read my book. And he said that he had given a copy of the book when it first came out to a guy named Frank Pavlico, one of his underlings. And he had inscribed the book, Sometimes You Can Believe Everything You Read. Right after that happened, the FBI contacted me. Now, I'm not talking about Bob Garrity. Bob is long ago retired, and Bob and I are, as I mentioned, very close friends. This was a real agent, a new guy, a guy named Andy Sluss, and he called me up, and we had a great conversation. Now, they can't go public with this because they can't comment on this publicly, let me put it that way. Because the FBI cannot publicly comment on an active case. And as long as Chucky O'Brien is still alive, one of the conspirators, and living in Boca Raton, Florida, and as long as Tommy Andretta is still alive and living in your hometown of Las Vegas, the FBI can't say anything other than, let me have your tapes, Charlie, which I gave them. So that's the Hoffa matter. The Crazy Joey Gallo hit at Umberto's Clam House, after my first edition came out, there's a photograph of Frank Sheeran in it. There was a New York Times editor, a very respected woman. And the people at the Times knew from word of mouth that she had been at Umberto's when the hit went down. And so another journalist showed her a copy of Frank Sheeran in the book, I Heard You Paint Houses. And she said, that gives me chills. That's the man that did the shooting. And then I contacted retired Detective Joe Coffey, whose case it was, NYPD detective. And he said, absolutely. It was a lone gunman, even though the all the books on the Crazy Joey Gallo hit. And there were two movies, Peter Boyle of Everybody Loves Raymond, played Crazy Joey Gallo in one of the two movies. And all of them say that there were three Italians who burst into Umberto's and began firing away at Crazy Joey, who was there celebrating his 40th birthday. But Joe Coffey explained to me that he let that story of three gunmen remain out there as an integrity test, so that if an informant came forward and said, I've got some information for you on those three gunmen and was looking for a payday, Joe Coffey would dismiss the guy immediately, because Coffey knew it was not three gunmen, it was a lone gunman, and he knew that it was not an Italian man, it was a 6'4" Irishman. So, these cases are already solved in terms of corroboration.
Well, let's go back to Hoffa. So Buffalino gets to know Sheeran. Sheeran starts doing jobs for Buffalino, and then he's introduced to Jimmy Hoffa, becomes very close. Walk us through the steps of how do you say to Frank Sheeran, who adores and cares for Jimmy Hoffa, how do you say to a guy like that, listen, you're going to have to kill him. You're going to have to help us get rid of him.
Let me back up a little bit. I'm going to answer that question, but I want to tell you about Sheeran's first hit for Buffalino to let you know how they do it. They began to give Sheeran little jobs, go out to Jersey, a guy owes money, pick up the money from him. If he doesn't have it, show him your gun. And they give him a gun. And you don't use the gun in those days. Sheeran said later on, they began using the gun with the younger, wilder, cocaine-using mafia guys in the Philadelphia mob. But in the days that Frank was involved, this would be, say, 1957. Then one day, a guy named Whispers DiTullio proposes to Frank, and he was a hanger-on. He wasn't a made man or a mafia boss of any kind. That Frank torched a professional laundry, in the Philadelphia area, because he had this Whispers DiTullio had lent money to a rival laundry, and the rival laundry was having trouble competing with this other laundry, and as a consequence, they weren't able to pay on a regular basis, pay this Whispers DiTullio. So Frank agreed for 10 grand to torch the laundry. He went down to the laundry and began casing it. The next thing you know, he's called into a meeting with Angelo Bruno, the boss of the Philly family, and Russell Buffalino, who was not merely the boss of upstate Pennsylvania. He was the boss of all of Pennsylvania outside of Philadelphia. He was also the boss of all of upstate New York, parts of New Jersey, and parts of New York City. He kept a hotel apartment at the Hotel Consulate in New York. And very powerful man. And they sat down with Frank, and they said, what were you doing casing the Cadillac Laundry Supply Service, Linen Supply Service? And Sheeran said, well, Whispers DiTullio was going to pay me 10 grand to torch it. And Angelo said to him, do you know who owns a piece of that laundry? And Frank said, no, I don't. He said, I do. How come you didn't come to me and check? And then he pointed to Russell. And he said, no, because you're with Russell, I got to give you a chance. I got to give you one chance here. The people that run that laundry are part of the Jewish mafia. And they spotted you right away as somebody out of place who didn't belong there. And Whispers knows better. He should have checked with me. You should have checked with me. And now you got to take care of Whispers. So that became Frank's first hit, killing Whispers DiTullio. And it was either him or me. He saw the newspaper the next day of the whack on DiTullio. And his first thought was, that could have been me. And so you start out and you're conditioned by these mafia people to know that if you say no to them, you're dead. If you don't play by their rules completely, you're dead. And the way it went down with Frank and Hoffa and Russell had been an ally of Hoffa's. He had been a staunch supporter of Hoffa's. But Hoffa just cut wilder and crazier with his rhetoric, his campaign rhetoric. Sheeran said Hoffa was just puffing, but it just went the wrong way with Russell. And finally, Hoffa wouldn't accept Russell's order to simply stay home with your grandchildren and get out of this race. And once he said to Russell, actually he said to Sheeran even worse, but once he said no to Russell, he was doomed. And when Frank tried to tell him that he was doomed afterwards, Hoffa said they wouldn't dare. Well, you know, Frank had to repeat that to Russell, because God forbid they had the place wired, because they do that too. The mafia did that too in those days. They would wire something like Hoffa's hotel room. And excuse me. In fact, Hoffa went to trial once because he had bugged somebody's rivals in his union. He had hired a guy to bug their meeting place. So, you know, you say no to Russell, and you're gone. Well, Sheeran did everything he could short of saying no. He tried to convince Hoffa to stop this crazy campaign to take back the union. He tried to say things to Russell to kind of placate Russell and keep Hoffa alive. And finally, it seemed to be working. Russell agreed to allow a meeting between Hoffa's biggest rival in the mafia, a man named Tony Provenzano, in Detroit, a meeting set up by Tony Giacalone. And these are all people on Bob Garrity's
right. We're gonna stop it there because the music tells us we're going to a break. When we come back, the conclusion of that part of the story of the circumstances that led to Jimmy Hoffa's murder, and then what happened to the body. We're talking with Charles Brandt, author of I Heard You Paint Houses. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.